Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Dave Packer. Israel has launched an attack at Iran. President Trump had told reporters it could well happen. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calling the attack preemptive.
If not stopped, Iran could produce a nuclear weapon in a very short time. It could be a year. It could be within a few months, less than a year. This is a clear and present danger to Israel's very survival.
The extent of any damage in Iran not yet clear, but Iranian response in the form of missiles or drones is expected. ABC's Marcus Moore is in Tel Aviv.
The air raid sirens going off and people being told to go to the nearest shelter gives you some idea of really what they're preparing for here. So far, where we are, we have not heard any explosions or we have not even heard of anything incoming, but the concern is still there.
The strike comes as the Trump administration and Iran were supposed to hold a sixth round of nuclear negotiations on Sunday. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
It's the Brewers and the Cardinals. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers opening a four-game series at home tonight against the Cardinals. On the mound from Milwaukee making his major league debut is Jacob Mizorowski. 6'7", a fastball that's been clocked at 103 miles per hour, was drafted by the Brewers 3 years ago. Meanwhile, veteran pitcher Aaron Savalle has now reportedly been asked to be traded after the Brewers reassigned him to the bullpen this week. NBA Finals, the Pacers beat the Thunder 116-107 to take a two-game to one lead. Tyrese Halliburton says Brad Weber, his coach from Oshkosh North High, was at the game.
It's important for me at a time like this to talk to people whose opinions I respect. Coach Weber is one of those, you know, being my high school coach. Coach Prohm is in the back there, my college coach. You know, I've had many conversations with those guys. You know, these games can get crazy, and, you know, I think what I've learned from those guys as my coaches and Coach Carlisle, that people follow the leader.
That's the Pacers' Tyrese Halliburton with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Now there's a new way to take charge of your blood sugar. Introducing New Garlic Healthy Blood Sugar Formula from the makers of the nation's best-selling garlic supplement. New Garlic helps maintain healthy blood sugar levels with clinically supported levels of garlic, plus a custom blend of vitamins and minerals, and it's odor-free. Take charge of your blood sugar with New Garlic Healthy Blood Sugar Formula. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Looks like Elon blinked. Said that, well, you know, my recent social media post may have gone too far. They went too far. He regrets some of them. He regrets, they might take my welfare away. Also, Trump's military big parade coming over the weekend. A lot of folks not tuning in. I won't be. It's not going to get much mainstream media coverage, but I'm sure the right-wing echo chamber will be all over it. They will have correspondents on the ground. Now, it's interesting. A lot of Republicans, they got other things to do that day. Yeah, it is what it is. Also, Trump's love affair with the military, send it into L.A., the 700 Marines, may deploy military to other cities now. So it could be yours, which kind of explains why the approval ratings slid a bit. Now just 38% of registered voters approve, and those are the diehard of the diehard. Also, thank you, ABC News, for your cowardice. As they've decided not to renew the senior national correspondent Terry Moran's contract because he had the audacity to say that Stephen Miller is a world-class hater. You stand up for your reporters. And the reason I bring up Miller is because he's the guy who brought us the Home Depot target. ICE going after those, you know, those people who are the rapists and murderers. You know, who are cutting your grass and, you know, building your deck and doing all your work. Yeah. Because ICE is ICE is going after those rapists and murderers in workplaces across the country. And one of the ones that I found interesting, Politico did a story on this Omaha meat processing plant where the company president's like, I don't know. Why us? We do everything by the book. He said that the plant uses E-Verify, the federal database that checks immigration status of all the employees. He said, we go by the book. We do what we're told. And E-Verify, said that these folks were great. They're fine. Put them to work because all of his people are gone. And evidently the immigration officials who were rounding up his workers said, the E-Verify system's broken. Yeah, it's broken. And the question is, who broke it? Was this a Doge break? Hey, we're just going to ignore any of this information because we just want to gather as many people and have the biggest impact possible. And you gotta wonder, what this is going to do to food prices going forward, because I'm seeing videos on social media of ICE agents chasing people across fields. They were working, picking crops. And I started thinking about John McCain when McCain ran for president. Said he'd pay people, white guys, $50 an hour to go out there and pick lettuce. There weren't a lot of takers. And I've seen these stories, of people, we'll pay $25 or $30 an hour. You just come out and pick apples. Not a lot of takers. So it's going to be interesting as we have these big, audacious displays of enforcement, people in costumes with their faces covered, chasing people through the fields. I got to think it's going to have a chilling effect on immigrant labor coming to pick your food. And I got to imagine that this is going to show up in the labor market. And I got to imagine that it's going to somehow affect the economy. Now, the World Bank has said that they're predicting growth this year to be the slowest since the 1960s. They say that they have lowered the forecast of nearly 70% of the economies across the country, mostly because of trade and basically discourse about trade is what they said. And that's code for our orange baby. The question is, are you ready for the shock? Strawberries, $11 a pound. Going to be interesting to see how this plays itself out. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Mateus Verdengo going to be here to share some thoughts on the immigration labor issue. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. In 1981... the Los Angeles Dodgers dropped the first two games of the World Series to their rivals, the New York Yankees. The Dodgers would come roaring back, sweeping the next four games, and so close the curtain on one of the strangest seasons in baseball history. The strangeness of the season began on this day in labor history. This was the first day of a strike that would last until August 9th. Nearly a third of all games were canceled. The reason for the strike was free agency. The players had won the right to become free agents a year after their contracts ended. Before this change, owners could renew players' contracts year after year, effectively stopping players from testing their market value with other teams. Determined to reverse the gains won by the players' union, owners brought in Roy Graby as a negotiator. Graby had a tough reputation for representing management for General Electric and for Pan American World Airlines. He took that same hard-nosed approach to the baseball bargaining table. The owners wanted the right to receive a player of comparable value for any player lost to free agency. This would effectively discourage teams from signing free agents if they had to give up another valuable player in return. The players' union understood this was a tactic to undermine free agency. Many also saw it as an attempt to break the players' union. Sports Illustrated magazine declared it the walkout owners provoked. Finally, the two sides agreed to a compromise that kept the practice of free agency intact. In a controversial decision, baseball owners decided to split the season into two. The teams with the best records from each half of the strike-divided season went to the playoffs. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, the World Bank is predicting the weakest growth globally since the 1960s. Their statement, without swift course correction, the harm to living standards could be deep. And yeah, it's all about the trade. It's all about all the craziness that's coming out of here. Our guy did this. So, you know, all those people who say, we're gonna make America great again, I think we're going to make America poor. But here to share some thoughts on what's it gonna look like in this country if you take all of those immigrant workers out of the economy. If we really do go round up 1 million people a year, 10 million people in total, and ship them out, what's going to happen? And here to share some thoughts on what that might look like, I've asked my friend Mateus Vernango to come share some thoughts. Mateus is a professor of economics at Bucknell University. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick.
So let's start with the big question. You know, how are these immigration raids and the increased enforcement going to influence the labor market as a whole and really the overall economic productivity of the country? How do you think this is going to work itself out if they do what they say they're going to do?
Yeah, well, that's the big if. So I think one of the issues is the degree of uncertainty. We don't know exactly what will happen. Even the trade stuff, in all fairness, I have to say that I'm a big fan of the TACO, you know, sort of acronym for Trump. Trump always, you know, chickens out. And I think that's, you know, have been very accurate. So we don't know exactly how much of the trade stuff will stick. And the same goes to the immigration, you know, sort of stuff. Having said that, so obviously, you know, the raids are happening. Los Angeles is on fire, so stuff is happening, so it's not zero. The obvious thing is that the overall level of employment will depend a lot on how the macroeconomy does. And you know, as I said, I don't think that at this point yet the trade issues are what may throw us into recession, but there is a risk of a recession, and I think that it's indirect. It's the fear that the tariffs will keep inflation up, which, you know, or increase prices, and the Fed may keep interest rates up, and that will have an impact on housing and consumption and so on and so forth, and that may lead to a recession. So far, you know, I would say a slowdown is the most obvious scenario. If we go into, you know, the consequences of the labor market, it will be very uneven then. Because, you know, if the economy slows down and there are jobs in certain places, certain types of jobs that are mostly done by immigrants, you know, construction, agriculture, and so on and so forth, there'll be shortages on those sectors. And obviously that will generate, you know, problems for all of us. So there'll be issues about, you know, inflation and so on and so forth that will be related to that. So it is, you know, something that definitely, I think, to some extent, it's probably already happening, so that in certain sectors, this is already visible. And, right. You know, the reports of the BLS so far don't show enough, but we're early on this.
Well, you're most certainly, pushing just the threat of all this, pushing workers underground, because as we talked about a moment ago, the reality is with Stephen Miller, you know, going after all the Home Depots and going after employers, and, you know, places of work, it's interesting that they've chosen that. You're pushing people further underground. But the argument then, and obviously you're the professor here, the argument, if you're writing this down on paper, by taking all these undocumented workers out, all of these immigrant workers out, that should open up jobs for Americans. And, you know, since there is a shortage of labor, it should raise the price of labor. So we could get, you know, $50 an hour. If I remember John McCain's offer when he ran for president, you know, people to go pick lettuce for $50 an hour, that could happen, right?
yes. I mean, the tariffs can bring all the manufacturing jobs back to Detroit. So, I mean, sure, You know, I mean, things could happen. It's very unlikely. So, and in part because the mechanisms are not exactly, you know, simply, you know, supply and demand. So it's not like, you know, although it would be fun if it was just simple as that. You stop the supply of immigrants, and you know, and those, you know, cause wages to go up and more Americans to want to get into perhaps those jobs. But a lot of this is not as simple as that. These are, you know, I mean, it's hard to move. As you know, labor markets are segmented. People, you know, have their own sort of, you know, capabilities that build over the years. They don't switch from one sector to the other immediately, and so on and so forth. So it's very unlikely that those shortages will be sort of simply, you know, switched, you know, and you'll get more good jobs for America. These are not good jobs, and they won't become good jobs. So what this is really about, it's creating fear, first of all, so that they throw people underground, and then they allow the exploitation of those same workers. So they create fear so that people don't try to cross the border, one. And I think that there is a backlash against immigrants and people that come from abroad, people with accents, people that may not assimilate and change the country. There are all sorts of, I mean, the immigrant population, the foreign-born is 15%. That's a, you know, historical height. It's as, you know, early 20th century. So those are not untypical things to be used, you know. And the fear is to cause, you know, it's to create conditions to pay less and to exploit those workers that are in those sectors that are afraid that, you know, La Migra will come and grab them and take them away. And so that allows, you know, unscrupulous, you know, bosses to underpay them, you know, do all kinds of things that are illegal. So that's at the end of the day. I'm pretty sure that Trump as a boss in casinos and whatnot, you know, and in construction.
Well, we're not going to go after those businesses. Those are the sufficiently loyal. But because, you know, I was going to ask you, you know, what happens to wages when you push workers underground, and who benefits from that scenario? Because I think that's part of what's at play here. As you're pushing workers further underground, I got to assume, and maybe you'll correct me, that wages are gonna plummet. Working conditions are going to get worse. Injury rates are probably going to be you know, undetectable, but probably go up. And, well, the employers of these people are going to line their pockets.
No, that's it. You just define it. This is not, I mean, it's, again, look at what they've done to the National Labor Review Board. It is about, you know, weakening labor. And this is what this is all about. And it's a significant fraction of the labor force, and it puts fear. And so it is about that. It's about the exploitation of workers. It will lead to lower wages. You know, there is, I should say, even if you have, you know, and there are reasons people are afraid of the massive numbers of immigrants that are coming in, immigrants have not affected wages down. Historically, the evidence of that is weak, contrary to what everybody thinks. They do not munch on welfare. You know, they pay more, you know, immigrants pay more taxes than they get into welfare. So they benefit society as a whole from the fiscal point of view. Whether you think that it's good to have a diverse society or not, it's a different discussion. But, you know, from the fiscal point of view, which the thing is, oh, they're, you know, coming here to benefit from, you know, the welfare system that we have. That's not true. I mean, they end up paying more in taxes than they do get in terms of benefits from welfare. That's very well documented. I mean, it's one of those, you know, facts, you know, which are not particularly fashionable these days, but those are facts. You know, they don't cause, you know, fiscal strains. Quite the opposite. They benefit the economy because the economy grows and so on and so forth. Most people that immigrate are very entrepreneurial. They work hard because they have to send money back home. And so they are hardworking, you know, entrepreneurial people that actually, you know, improve, you know, society in many ways. So the reasons for doing that are ultimately associated, I think, on the one hand, it's fear. And the fear should sort of spread, and it is about bringing wages down. It's about bringing labor standards down, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but hold on. And I gotta break out my alternative facts here, because President Trump told us they're all rapists and murderers, And they're released from prison. So you're telling me something.
Well, some have Hamlet.
Telling me stuff that I haven't heard before.
What? Sorry.
No, I mean, this is what my redhead friends are going to tell me. Look, they're all rapists and murderers. That's what our president said.
Yes, I know. And the sad thing about this is that you can always find one or two cases, and they'll highlight those one or two cases to death, and so they'll be on Fox News all the time. And
yeah, like my favorite picture. Have you seen the picture going around Twitter? There's like 15 camera people, you know, in front of this garbage can that was just a garbage can that was knocked over as a small little campfire in front of it. There are like 15 photographers all crouched down trying to get their angle and make this little tiny, you know, this little piece of paper on fire in front of the dented trash can. Some big, giant thing. Because, hey, you know, if it bleeds or leads, if it burns, it leads. However you want to frame that. Because, again, we got a narrative. We got alternative facts to keep, Mateus.
Yes, no, that will be pushed, and I think it's sad, and I think also I should say there is a lot of this that it's distraction, it's the distraction of the week, so we are trying to move the cycle is very fast this day, so Musk 1 week, the tariffs the other, immigration this week, next week it will be, you know, God knows exactly what, but so it's part of the distraction so that, you know, people don't see how, you know, on the one hand he's mismanaging the economy, on the second, you know, he's, you know, benefiting himself in terms of the kinds of things that they're doing. I think we talked to you during the first presidency, I think one of the unreported things more this time than the previous time is how he has normalized the use of the presidency for personal gain.
Oh God, yes.
It is absolutely about his personal profits, his brand. You know, we talk about immigration. We're talking, the U.S. always had programs which allowed wealthy individuals to essentially, you know, buy themselves into the immigration process and eventually into citizenship.
Yeah, $5 million now.
Now it's called the Trump Gold Card. I mean, even that, it's an American thing. It's, you know, it's something that it's part of the normal process of immigration that always existed or existed for a long while. But now it's the Trump Gold Card. And so he has sort of, you know, branded the immigration process, you know. So, you know, that is, I'm shocked to how much this has been normalized. It's okay. You know, nobody, this last cycle of election, you know, the last election, nobody even brought the topic of him not providing his taxes. This has gone completely out of the, you know, it's now
exactly
the norm. The Democrats have to show their tax, you know, records, and Republicans don't. And that's okay. It's part of the how the, you know, political system works. So
right,
that we got to that point is I think impressive.
No, it is impressive. But, you know, as Mike Johnson said, this is part of the justification. As where others like, you know, Joe Biden's kid Hunter and his brother did things supposedly in the back rooms, smoke filled back rooms. Donald Trump does it right out in front of you. The grift is right there in front of you. You get to get a face full, a nose full of what that is. He's not hiding anything. He's pilfering and robbing and stealing at every opportunity and doing it right in front of you.
It's personal business. It's his personal, the White House is his personal business. It looks like the Trump Tower, you know, it's all gilded and, you know.
And we're going to get a ballroom.
Yes, it is essentially, you know, so it is his personal, it's his personal business. It's a personal way of making money. He's making deals. He's getting an airplane. I mean, seriously, I mean, it's very hard to, so the immigration process again, and, you know, it is, he was involved in business actually that, you know, to some extent have great numbers of immigrants. He has dealt with this kind of thing, so he knows that it's advantageous to have immigrants afraid. This is what's, you know, all about.
Yeah.
Let me
ask you the other side of this, because there's the, who does this hurt more? Does this hurt, you know, big businesses? Like we talked about a meatpacking plant earlier, about how, you know, basically the whole workforce was rounded up. Or does this hurt small businesses in your local community? Like, you know, the neighbor had, as a guy who cuts their grass and does their bushes and stuff. you know, they hired two Mexican guys to go up there and do it. I know the guy who owns the company isn't one of those two guys who are out there doing the work. When they come take the who, I guess that's the question. Who's harmed more outside of obviously the immigrants and the workers? Is it big business? Is it small business?
So, you know, it depends a lot on the sectors. And so there are sectors that depend considerably more on smaller businesses to function. And then, you know, so the cleaning up the bushes and, you know, gardening and so on and so forth is definitely, you know, small businesses. But let me say this. In general, big businesses can always, you know, because they have resources, they have access to credit, they can, you know, hire temps at higher wages and pass them to the consumer. You know, there are many mechanisms by which they can sort of manage, you know, shortages in the short run than a small business. A small business may, you know, if they don't have the guy that, you know, will go to, you know, do the other job. So while they're doing another one, they lose the business. And so, and that may be enough, you know, to put them out of business, you know, literally. So I think that at the end of the day, big corporations are fine with this because, ultimately, weakening of the labor force. I mean, those workers that will come back to the meatpacking, you know, plant will be afraid of complaining about anything, you know. And, you know, smaller businesses, they'll have a much harder time in adjusting. So I think at the end of the day, this hurts always, you know, these kind of things in which your, repression of workers ends up hurting not just the workers, but also small businesses. And so those are probably going to be irrespective of the differences in sectors, which I think will, you know, matter. And I wouldn't off the top of my, you know, head know, you know, if these sectors are dominated by bigger or smaller firms. But, you know, my guess is smaller firms would be hurt the most.
Last question I've got for you, because, you know, obviously the comments during the campaign where they were going to try and round up, you know, 1 million people and 10 million overall. What is that? What would that? What does that long term look like in this country that has benefited so richly from you know every couple of generations having you know younger labor, cheaper labor coming in to provide you know products and things that that everyone else gets at a lower price? What does this mean for the economy long term in the event that they actually succeed? And do you think it's possible? Or do you agree with where I started right when Trump took office? We're going to see a lot of high profile stuff. There's going to be a lot of imagery, but overall, he's not going to make a dent in that million number. So I'm curious your thoughts.
So let me say one thing that we didn't talk that it's related to long term effects. I think that also something that he's doing. He kept saying that he doesn't want, you know, he wants to bring the best. We're not bringing the best. We're bringing the rapists. We're bringing the, so. But he is attacking universities and he's attacking, you know, students. You know, we get, you know, I mean, there are 300,000 Chinese students in the United States. There are like I think 1,000 students. Yeah, I'm kidding, but yeah, it's nothing. American students in China, and there is a reason for that, and it's a good thing for the United States that students come to the United States and want to, you know, study here and learn and many of them stay and produce and do things and so on and so forth. There are, you know, a story in the New York Times of a student that came here, you know, and eventually won a Nobel Prize and, you know, immediately as soon as all of this started happening, you know, and he got a lot of offers to leave the country, you know, so which he has not done yet in the case of this particular guy. So the point is that this kind of thing is hurtful for the United States long run. The you know, at the beginning he suggested that there will be, you know, camps, that they were gonna round out people and have the camps. Stephen Miller did talk about that. They started sending people, if you remember, to Guantanamo in Cuba. And so that seemed not to be the case. We're rounding up people and sending them mostly from certain places, but, you know, Venezuelans and, you know, and so on and so forth. But, you know, they're sending them to us to El Salvador. The numbers are, you know, as far as I understand, the numbers yet are not, you know, they're still lower than the numbers of deportations that happened during Obama. And so these are not particularly large numbers historically. I mean, they're large because we have a lot of immigration and it's still high, but, you know, but it's not that he's going to reach those numbers. And I think you're right. There is a lot of hype it's the taco thing. So this is about, I don't think it is about getting rid of a million people that they don't have and they will not put. You know, it would require efficiency, and
they've been anything but that,
planning and ability to do things right in order to actually be capable of massively taking all of these people from the American economy. Huh. And I don't think they have the capability. They're incompetent and incapable of doing, thank God, to some extent. But, you know, I don't think it was the objective. The objective is to create fear and to.
And that they've done.
Yes, that's the story.
Mission accomplished. Mateus, as always, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick.
Our good friend Mateus Fernando. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you agree with me? Do you think this is all about the show? Do you think they're going to get... Do you think they could possibly get to a million people? Do you think? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Tonight and tomorrow, scattered showers and thunderstorms with cloudy sky. Low tonight, low 50s. High tomorrow, mid 60s. Slight rain chances for the weekend, highs into the 70s. Temps start to warm up into next week as highs jump into the 80s.
Currently 57 degrees.
Summer. It's our Scotty Summer statewide text to win contest on your local Civic Media radio station. For a complete list of contest rules, log on civicmedia.us/contest-terms.
Mommy, how come I can't sit in the front seat?
Because I love you and you're just not ready yet.
Putting your kids in the right seat for their age and size is an act of love. Check that your kids are in the right seat at nhtsa.gov/the-right-seat. Love protects. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Congresswoman LaMonica McIver was indicted, three counts related to that incident that happened at the ICE detention center in Newark, New Jersey. Anybody surprised by it? I was expecting it, because this is what we're going to start doing now. Evidently the three counts, allegedly for forcibly impeding and interfering with federal law enforcement officers, faces up to 17 years in prison. And here to share some thoughts on, is there something here, or is this just political, you know what? That's why I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So what do you make of this? Does this hold water? Is this something that's indictable, something that should have been indicted? Any thoughts?
Well, you never know how these will come out, because you've got juries, unless she would do a plea deal to stop this. I don't know. I mean, who knows what you do? I was faced myself, go to trial or do a plea deal, and I didn't have $3.2 million because I was tempted. So I did a plea deal. Of course, I wasn't indicted. Mine was a poker game, as I call it, no indictment, but we might indict you. So a situation like the Congresswoman's now, she's indicted. So the question remains, because I saw the video. I watched the video multiple times. And the question remains, was it assault or not? Did she impede or not? Or with her position as a member of Congress and it being a federal facility, did she have the ability to go up and question to be let in? So there's a lot of unknowns, Rick, to it. Now, in normal course, things don't usually go this far. Usually when you're indicted as some type of, behavior where they find out bribery or dealing with lobbyists or your campaign account or something. So this is a situation where who knows what a jury of peers will do? Yeah. I mean, who knows? It's completely unknown. Like I said, I watched the tape. Did she hit somebody? No. Did she Were they pushing at each other of sorts? Yes. When I say they, the feds and her, you know. So a jury may look at it in a totally different light and may not look at it as an assault. We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, just I guess the time that we're in. But, you know, when you've got someone like Trump in the White House, this stuff doesn't surprise me at all. And speaking of Trump in the White House, evidently, and I don't know if this is 100% accurate, but we're getting rid of FEMA, evidently, after hurricane season, even though the guy who's the head of FEMA didn't know there was a hurricane season or when it was, I guess. But evidently, we're getting rid of FEMA.
Well, when I got elected to Congress, we were going to sell office buildings, all right, including, I think, one of the House buildings at the time. We were going to sell it. We were going to, if we built additions like the Visitor Center, we were going to allow for businesses to, you know, like the Citibank stairway.
Naming rights.
Or whatever.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. A funny story, real quick, I'll tell you, because, you know, you're a union member. There was a congressman, and he was from California, and Congressman Cox, in fact, was his name. He was from California, and he was just going on and on and on about, well, we're going to do this, and businesses, you know, and we can have the Citibank hallway. And so I stood up and said, that's fine with me. We're also probably going to have the Teamsters wing. Or the AFL-CIO. And it's like, oh. And I said, yeah, if you're going to privatize and, you know, people put their names on things. So that kind of ended very fast. But, you know, you hear these things, the Department of Education and FEMA and whatever. Something has to exist. You can maybe say we're doing away with the name FEMA, but there has to be some entity that coordinates the Fed and the state and the local. So it's going to be there. I don't care what they're saying. There's going to be something.
There'll be something. Whether it's effective or not, whether it's paying out to the Trump heirs and the Trump loyalists, that's yet to be seen. And I think that's probably certain. But again, yeah. We will find out.
And you make a point about what's to be seen, because I was there when we created Homeland Security. Speaker Hastert said to me, because I funded the committees, he said, fund the temporary Homeland Security Committee, which still exists today. All right. That was back in 2001. Fund it, and then we're going to have it temporary. And I said, it'll never be temporary. So then all of a sudden they said, well, we're going to create Homeland Security and take this division out, and it's going to save so much money. Excuse me. As you know, and I know, it didn't save money. It never does.
So you were part of, you were back during that time of Homeland Security. Could you have imagined that a former Heritage Foundation intern, a self-described Trumplican, basically a 22-year-old college graduate with no government leadership experience whatsoever, would lead the terrorism part of the Department of Homeland Security?
I saw it. I was amazed. Look, there's some very qualified people in government. I know some people tend to stereotype the entire government's bad. There are really some dedicated public servants in government and some really qualified people. And then I've seen some really not qualified people. I think this guy, for the position he has, probably takes the cake. I mean, there is no relationship to what he's in charge of that has existed in his life. Now, if he was 22 and at the age of 16 had started to do this and that and didn't even have a college degree, that'd be okay if he had some kind of experience. But he was a gardener, wasn't he?
Yeah.
A gardener.
But most importantly, right. I think he may have written the good essay, the loyal essay, because evidently we're going to be hiring federal employees based on, you know, the loyalty essay. What's your favorite Donald Trump executive order and why?
Well, he did something. I don't know what, but this one really, really amazed me.
A loyalist. He's going to do what he's told. He's not going to ask any questions. He's going to rubber stamp whatever Stephen Miller wants. That's where my mind went. So, you know, all the horrible things that are going to come down the road, this guy's going to happily put his name on without questioning. Also, I got to get your thoughts on the big, beautiful bill. Evidently, voters not thrilled with it. You know, Republicans are struggling because they're trying to pull out some of the stuff that people might actually want, like not taxing tips. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah, there's a struggle in this bill, first of all, of the fiscal impact. Now, if you ask me to debate against this bill, I can do it. If you ask me to debate for this bill, I can do it, because, you know, when they say, well, it's 2.5 trillion now, or it was 4.5 trillion, you know, into the red category of spending. Well, Congress, Rick, as you know, you've been around, Congress says, well, if we do this in 10 years, here's how the taxpayers react. It's false accounting. It might be a half a trillion deficit. It might be a trillion. It might be 10 trillion. I don't know. They don't know. All right. Now, the second thing is this. They are paying for what they've already done. So the budget's already out of whack. They ought to start honest budgeting processes like we used to have. And then they can start to argue what's in balance or not over a period of time.
Right.
This is just a false argument, because they're not going to be able to bring this all in balance. Again, debt ceilings, reconciliation bills are paying for things they have already issued or spent or are in the process. So this is smoke and mirrors. They're going to get a bill. They're going to get a bill. They cannot not get a bill. It just depends how they craft the votes together. One way or another, they're going to get one. But the Senate's going to, you know, look at changes and what they're going to do. And they're going to look at people's seats in the Senate. And then it kicks back to the House, and Trump will get on the phone, and eventually they will get a bill. It will not be in balance. I think the scariest thing about any of these bills is when they talk about no debt ceiling. I mean, really? Now, the debt ceiling used to be a non-controversial vote until Barack Obama became president.
Yeah.
And it became life or death.
Yeah, and now Trump wants to do away with it, even though for many times, we're never going to raise it. Yeah, okay. But
can
I
imagine if Barack Obama had said, I want to do away with the debt ceiling? Think about it.
Think about a lot of things had it been done that way. But I misspoke a second. I said no tax on tips. I meant no tax on overtime. That's what Republicans are balking about.
Right.
So you're in the camp that it's going to get done. There will be something. Because look, you're right. You can argue both sides of it. It's 1,119 pages. There's a lot in there that you can pick and choose to put your stake your flag on.
Well, and that's the point I was making to somebody today who called me on this and said, I want to talk to you about the budget. I said, well, which line? Because it's not a budget. And in the budget process, you bring up, for example, Planned Parenthood. Are you for it? Are you against it? At what level? Yes or no? You bring up legal services. You bring up EPA. You bring all of these things into a debate and an amendment process. Then you're accountable. You voted for this, you voted for that. That's not how any of them do it anymore, because now you've got one vote. And if you say, Rick Smith says, hey, Bob, you know, why did you vote this way? Well, yeah, I had one vote. It was on a whole package. I would have voted if that was separate. I would have voted another way. You've got the perfect cover answer, because they're omnibus bills that at the end of the day do not do anybody, any of the taxpayers, justice the way they're doing these.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm right there with you. I also got to get your thoughts on what's going on in Los Angeles and other cities across the country, as evidently we're going to be sending more military personnel into other cities. We've got the big, beautiful military parade that's coming up this weekend. I'm told it's going to rain, so I don't think God is very happy with that. But I wanted to get your thoughts.
Well, the parade, a lot of members are having other things they're going to do. I saw that article today. As far as L.A., it's come down to a Newsom-Trump thing. As far as the legal right, I'm not a legal scholar, Lyndon Baines Johnson, back in 65, I believe it was, sent in troops to protect some protesters, to protect them. And it was over the civil rights issue without the request. So probably in a court of law, Trump has the ability to do what he does, because the hook is these are federal officials that are being protested, et cetera. If anybody goes near a federal building, I mean, there's a lot of peaceful protesters, and then there's people. And look, anytime these happen, anytime, you also have a group of people that will go there that probably have no vested interest in anything, and they do damage.
Right.
It happens a lot. They are outside influences who, you know, see a fire and want to go attend it. And that's what I think you have here.
No, it'll be just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. But it also brings up the question of, you know, if he had this power and he knew he had this power, where was he on January 6th?
Well, of course. I mean, that's always going to be debated. You know, one of its destruction. And I've used this example with you on your show 100 times when asked about the Capitol. If you and I go, you know, anywhere in Pennsylvania or Ohio, and we bust the window of a U.S. post office for some reason, and you and I walk inside that post office, I know what we're going to be eating in something called a main line. That's a federal prison cafeteria. It's called main line.
Right.
All right. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah. For me, this whole scenario, everything that's going on, just highlights for me that the failure of Congress to act in any way, shape, or form to fix our immigration problems. I keep going back to that.
You make the valid point. I had 2 different discussions this week by people who called me, and they genuinely wanted to go over the issue. One of the people, you know, was, don't even let tourists in here. All right. The other friend of mine, she just is like, you know, open borders, not to be no wall, blah, blah, blah. Trump this and Trump that. And what I was telling both of them, of however they feel, is fine. It's their free opinion. But here's the bottom line from when I was there and people before me. It was never undertaken by Congress really in an effective way. And during the Biden election, we got to face the fact that bill was so complicated. If 1,500 came in one day, then you do this. You know, Congress has allowed presidents, Trump, Biden, Obama, Bush, Clinton. I mean, we can go way back. Congress, by not sitting down, and it's a solvable problem, by the way, for the most part. It is.
Yep.
It's solvable. You know that. I know that. Both sides give on some issues. You got security of the border wall, and you've got path to citizenship. Those are 2 big issues that people will have to give on. And you're 100% right, Rick, because Congress never acts appropriately. All of this back and forth and power is put right into the hands of every single president, and is going to continue that way until Congress codifies law and sets the tone.
Yep. And this is something that we should be calling for immediately. Republicans control everything. They have the ability to pass some immigration reform legislation.
Right.
It's just not that important. Finally, got to get your thoughts on the big deal with China. I'm sure you've seen there's a big, beautiful agreement. This is going to be great. It's going to be the best trade deal ever. You know, China is going to be in line. We're going to I don't know what we're doing. It looks like they agreed to what things used to be like. It doesn't look like there's anything better than what we had prior. But I'm curious your thought.
Well, it's interesting because both sides, both Xi and Trump, made some very interesting moves. Trump basically started kicking out Chinese students and making it clear he was going to kick out Chinese students. And Xi said, fine, we're going to cut off the dirty earth, the rare earth, minerals you need that functions in everything, our refrigerators, our cell phones. You know, now both sides are going to reinstitute. We're going to get the dirty earth, as I call it, the rare earth, and Chinese students can be here.
So what changed?
Trump said today that he never did want them to leave, except last week. So there's, I don't know yet, there's a percentage, and maybe, you know, both sides got a little bit of give and take on reciprocity. I'm not sure. Look, I like tariffs. You know that. I like fair trade, not free trade. I've always been that way. I like the fact that Trump was the first president, said he was going to go after China. He did. Biden kept a lot of those tariffs. I like that. But when the whole tariff mechanism was rolled out, the whole scheme this year, it was rolled out all over the world, and that quickly evaporated. So now it's boiled down to China. So this is, if we win a little bit, Trump will have a political win on, you know, what he did with China. As far as the rest of the world, maybe Vietnam gives a little bit, India gives a little bit. I don't know what happens. But the whole rollout, as you know, has vanished.
Yeah, see, for me, it's just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. We're still going down. It's still the same number of chairs. They're just being rearranged to look differently. Mm-hmm. But I don't see anything coming out of this other than Trump saying he declares victory. And I don't see American workers being better off. I don't see American consumers being better off. I don't see us being safer. I don't see our supply chains being stronger. I just see this as your three-card Monty showing you the card that you didn't pick.
And the supply chain, as you know, is the issue too. Look, we consume so much. For our percentage of the population, we consume enormous amounts of everything, yep, food, energy, et cetera. We can never totally, and I never said we should be isolationists. We always are going to need other parts of the world, but I think we have been, you know, treated unfairly. And I think, you know, the attitude of a lot of Americans over the years was, hey, I'll take that cheap product until the Chinese put us out of business. And then that cheap product, you know, got more expensive.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, what needs to happen, and it's not going to happen, I hope it happens one day, is where you get an administration that says, here's what's essential for our supply chain. And no matter what, we got to complete our supply chains. And we can't have automobiles where these missing three parts have to come from some other country, and we need to manufacture it, and we need to bite the bullet and do it. You know, rare earth mining, it's collapsed every time we've tried to do that with companies. So hopefully along the line, that's considered part of the whole trade situation, is how we complete supply chains for ourselves, I hope.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But Bob, as always, I appreciate the time. Great insight. I look forward to having you back again soon.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff, our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you agree with me? Do you think we've been treated unfairly? Or do you think as I do? American corporations have gotten fat and happy and greedy off screwing American workers. Want to hear your thoughts? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1904. That was the day that 18,000 workers in Chicago's stockyards went out on strike. Work in the stockyards was often brutal and dangerous. Thousands of workers toiled in the yards, many of them immigrants from Eastern Europe. They worked butchering and processing the hogs and cattle raised in the American West into meat for distribution by rail to consumers across the country. The industry gave Chicago the nickname Hog Butcher for the World. In 1904, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union organized a strike. The main demand was increased wages. The meatpacking companies were able to get scabs to cross the picket lines and act as strikebreakers. Most were African Americans and European immigrants. Many of these workers had not been organized by the union, which was dominated by the skilled German and Irish packing house workers. Novelist Upton Sinclair visited the stockyards during the strike to research conditions faced by the workers. In his famous novel, The Jungle, Sinclair gave a fictionalized account that captured the devastating impact of the scabs on the strike. He wrote, quote, "Such were the stockyards during the strike, while the unions watched in sullen despair, and the country clamored like a greedy child for its food, and the packers went grimly on their way. Each day they added new workers and could be more stern with the old ones, could put them on piecework and dismiss them if they did not keep pace." It was not until the 1930s when the stockyard unions took seriously the task of organizing across race, ethnic, and skill lines that they finally won a contract and gained the rights of union recognition.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Got to tell you, the comment by Bob there a second ago caught my ear, you know, because he said, you know, we've been treated unfairly by other countries, and I disagree with that. I don't think we've been treated unfairly. I think we've allowed ourselves to get screwed over because, you know, American corporations wanted that. I think the trade deals, like a lot of our bad policy, working exactly the way it was intended by the people who dreamt it up. We got rid of manufacturing. We lowered the cost of manufacturing. We got cheap junk. I'm not quite sure that they thought China would rise to the power level. That was an unintended error, I think. Maybe. I think maybe they thought they could do to China what they've done to all the other countries, which is give them bits and pieces. The difference is that the Chinese have been smart enough to you know, steal intellectual property, manipulate currency, you know, do all of the mercantilist things that have given them the manufacturing advantage. And we've done nothing over the years. A lot of talk. And this, I think what Trump is doing is a lot of talk. I don't think there's anything here that's going to make things any better. I don't think it's going to make our supply chains better. I don't think it's going to make national security stronger. I don't think any of that stuff is going to be addressed. I think this is all about getting himself out of a hole. This is all about Taco, you know, chickening out again. Because as I'm reading through this, and this is one of those things that makes me go, hold on. You were taking some pretty strong positions, and yet you've pretty much backtracked, chickened out, and now we're going to call that a victory. And look, I said this is what was going to happen from the beginning because we've seen this movie before. This is not new. I don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not that bright. But I do have a memory, and I do see how he operates. Break a bunch of stuff, cause a bunch of chaos, you know, get everybody all lathered up in the panties, and then make a bad deal and declare victory. Say, oh, the most tremendous, best, most incredible piece ever, and then move on. And when anyone questions it, oh, it's fake news, or oh, you're just anti-Trump. And the truth is yeah, I'm anti-Trump, but I do want him to get a good deal. I do want to reshore manufacturing. I do want to invest in future, in the future of this country, especially good jobs for my children and their children. I want to leave something to them worth inheriting. But the sad reality is he's just not the guy. I know there's a lot of bloviating, a lot of backslapping, a lot of PR, a lot of propaganda, but when the rubber really meets the road, the question I think every working person is going to have to ask is my life any better? Is this helping me put food on the table? Is this guy helping me get a better job, getting my kids through college or through school? Is this helping making me healthier? Am I getting health care? Am I getting access to good quality care? There's a lot of questions working people need to be asking, and we're not. Because we're distracted by the display that's on TV every night now, which is ICE people all dressed up in costumes going after the others. And I know my red hat friends are gleeful, all tingly in the panties over going after getting those, you know, those illegals, because they've been trained to believe that somehow that's going to make their lives better. I don't think it's going to. And I go back to what I said with Bob. All of this is Congress's failure. Everything we see is a failure of Congress to act and do its job. And it's not just this Congress. It's been numerous Congresses. So until we get that done, I think we're right here. But I appreciate taking time for me. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Dave Packard. Israel taking action against Iran, launching what it calls a preemptive strike. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying Iran presented a clear and present danger.
Now, as Prime Minister, I've made it clear time and again, Israel will never allow those who call for our annihilation to develop the means to achieve that goal. Tonight, Israel backs those words with action.
ABC's Selena Wang in Washington with a reaction from the U.S. State Department.
According to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, in the statement, he is stressing that there was no U.S. involvement in this attack. I'll just read to you part of it, saying tonight Israel took unilateral action against Iran. We are not involved in strikes against Iran, and our top priority is protecting American forces in the region. He goes on to say that Israel advised us that they believe this action was necessary for its self-defense.
Flights across Israel and Iran diverted to other countries to avoid Israeli and Iranian airspace. This is ABC News. You can add Washington State.